Recently, we had an attack aviation formation conducting an attack out of contact against a very robust air defense system. And the whole nature of the training event was they had to weave their way through this very sophisticated air defense system to get at a target using the exquisite technology of the Apache. A couple days later, we sat down with the leadership and showed them the exact track their Apache had taken as it approached the objective. One of their Apaches had taken because one of the pilots had a cell phone in the cockpit with him. And that would have compromised a significant amount of technology because it would have shown how we use our Apaches to maneuver around enemy air defense. It's those simple things that can cost us so much. So I think that awareness has driven real changes in behavior. And I'll just tell you, in the last 10 rotations, particularly since we bought those cell phone detectors, we've seen a dramatic change in behavior. People are starting to get the message.
Hello, fellow leaders, and welcome to the Military Leader Podcast. I'm Drew Stedman. I have studied leadership for 3 decades. I've put those lessons into practice as a U.S. Army officer, and I am passionate about growing leaders from every profession. In this podcast, you'll find conversations with today's most successful leaders. And I've got one goal: to deliver insight to help you become a better leader and then develop the leaders around you. My conversation today is with U.S. Army Brigadier General Kurt Taylor. Brigadier General Taylor commands the National Training Center in Fort Irwin, California. Fort Irwin is the Army's premier training center and one of the installations solely dedicated to making the Army's units and leaders ready for the next fight. In this episode, Brigadier General Taylor describes how NTC shapes its training scenarios to account for the changes in the character of warfare. He also shares leadership lessons from the dozens of rotations he's been a part of. We talk drone swarms, tank battles, and artillery. And he also warns that if you turn on a cell phone at NTC, you're putting your entire unit at risk. If you're a military leader, this is your business. And if you're not in the military, take note of Brigadier General Taylor's advice on how to seize opportunity and lead the team as conditions change around you. Okay, grab your notebooks. I know you're going to get a lot out of this episode. And when you do, I want to challenge you to take the next step. Here's your call to action. First, do something with what you've learned. Put these lessons into practice. Second, share this episode with your team. It's easy to do. Send in the link and ask what stood out to them. That's it. All you have to do is start a conversation. And of course, I greatly appreciate it when people share the episode on social media and leave reviews about what they got out of it. This episode is available on themilitaryleader.com along with a ton of other leadership writing and resources. And I hope you enjoy my conversation with Lead 6 at NTC, Brigadier General Kurt Taylor. General Taylor, sir, welcome to the Military Leader Podcast, and thank you for taking the time to connect with this community of leaders who are really plugging in from around the world. Sir, it's great to see you again. How are you?
It's great, Drew, and thanks for inviting me to be a part of this, and congratulations to you. I understand you're starting your third season, so yes, sir. I think in Hollywood that's the sign of a successful serialization. So well done. And I appreciate all the great message that you're communicating to your audience.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you for being a part of it. And we share actually a mentor so my first episode you might have seen was General Brown, and I could not think of a better leader to kick off a podcast like this. And it was a phenomenal conversation. I truly appreciate him for doing that.
Well, I'll tell you, I had the opportunity to listen to that podcast, and one of the questions you asked me to think about a little bit is, what's one leader that I admire the most in my, I think it's a leadership hero or mentor, someone that you've looked up to, and that's a no-brainer for me. 30 years in the military, I've never met a better leader. His passion, his commitment, his investment in people is amazing. So for all your listeners out there who heard General Brown's podcast, I'll tell you, he's the real deal. For those who haven't,
yes, sir.
Stop this right now, go back and listen to that one, and then if you got time, you can come listen to me. But what a phenomenal leader who really believes in investing in people and taught me how to be a senior leader and a brigade commander.
Yes, sir. That's the best endorsement I think I've heard so far on the show, honestly, sir. And you know what I really appreciated about General Brown is that he could find that arc of positivity in doing the job that sometimes some people try and it's a little bit cheesy and they don't quite get it right. He just nails it because he's authentic inside and he really cares for people, and that really resonated. assertive.
Yeah, absolutely. What he would tell me is he was an optimist with a short memory. I think he stole that quote from Churchill. Okay. But so true in leadership. I watched him struggle with setbacks. I watched him particularly getting Army University off the ground as I was working for him at that time on that effort. And I watched him drive organizational change. And there were a lot of setbacks in that. And he remained very, very positive and enthusiastic the whole time, which is, again, something I've tried to emulate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Well, we can get into leadership and the leader's effect on the organization as they go through mm-hmm. challenges a little bit later. Because there at NTC, you see challenges at every rotation. You see leaders at their high points and their low points. And so for the listeners out there who might not be familiar with NTC, would you take a moment just to describe the National Training Center and then the important role it plays in the Joint Force?
Yeah, so the National Training Center is about 1,200 square miles of desert out in the Mojave of Southern California, located about halfway between Los Angeles and Las Vegas. And it is and has been for the last 42 years where the Army conducts the world's best replication of large-scale combat operations. We did this. We founded the National Training Center in the shadow of the Yom Kippur War as we looked at the increasing lethality of large-scale combat operations and realized that no longer would we have an opportunity to learn from mistakes we make in the first battle of the future conflict because you could lose your army in an afternoon if you weren't ready for that first battle. And so we recognize that historically our nation has struggled with first battles, but we have adapted very quickly as an army. I mean, if you look at our history, we kind of get punched in the face in that first fight, and we learn quickly and we adapt. And so the goal of the NTC was to create that crucible experience of that first battle experience out in a tough, demanding desert, the most unforgiving terrain we could find and unforgiving conditions, replicate what the future conflict was going to look like, and then trigger that incredible ingenuity and adaptation we see in the Army. And so what the NTC continues to do today is to replicate that environment. So as a method, every month, about 4,700 soldiers come out to the National Training Center. They bring all their equipment in 7 different train loads of equipment, about 1,800 vehicles altogether once they draw some stuff from us. And then they create a armor or striker or infantry brigade combat team in the desert. And they move out from assembly area and they conduct 14 days of continuous operations. And they're fighting day and night against the best and most well-trained opposing force that we have in our Army today, and that's the 11th ACR Black Horse. So this morning, as the sun was coming up in the central corridor, the central valley of the National Training Center, about 1,500 soldiers from the Black Horse initiated an attack against a prepared defense of the 3rd Brigade, 4th Infantry Division. They brought in heavy artillery, chemical weapons, smoke, attack aviation, multiple attacks with drone swarms, and then the awesome killing power of soldiers that know how to fight and know the ground they're fighting on. They brought that against 3rd Brigade in a prepared defensive position. That battle finished up about less than an hour ago. It was epic, and I'll tell you, there was a lot of great learning on both sides and a lot of great fighting. I couldn't have been more proud of 3rd Brigade as they were hanging on by their fingernails, doing everything they could to defeat this enemy force.
Yes, sir. Well, let me highlight that for a second here. So I love that you said that it was just this morning that happened. So, you know, with the people out there, they're listening or maybe not familiar with how the Army trains day in and day out at the training centers and out at the different bases around the Joint Force, this training is going on. But the premier training center is the National Training Center, and millions and tens of millions of dollars are invested every month to bring those units there and to give them the fight of their lives in training so that they have a good day when it's the real fight of their lives. And so I think it's great just to highlight that while we're sleeping at night, you're out there seeing these brigades through to get better and better every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And we seek to create the most realistic training environment that we can. And so it's an unforgiving environment. I'll tell you, you know, as the sun was coming up or just prior to sunrise, the Op 4 targeted 6 of the U.S. units' command posts. Were really going after that. In many cases, they were unsuccessful because the command posts were either in using terrain properly, or they were appropriately dispersed, that the artillery had limited effect. In a couple cases, there was a lot of learning that happened. But we are going after every capability all at once. And what we want to do is we want to show the forces that come out here to train what it's like to fight an artillery-centric enemy, an enemy that can see you in depth and understand your disposition all the way back to your rear supply lines, and then has the ability to synchronize a variety of instruments of the combined arms team together to achieve a decisive effect, even for only a fleeting moment, and then exploit that with maneuver forces.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, in just a minute here, I'll ask you about the character of war and then how NTC is adapting to that. I think we can talk about the technologies, the command posts, the drone swarms, and that kind of thing there. But so as you look back at your time in the desert there, now you've been there several times as an OC, now the CG. What stands out for you personally? And I'll ask you to share maybe a war story here, but a moment of a hero moment, maybe a zero moment. What's your story in the desert, sir?
So I got to tell you, my first experience at the National Training Center, I was a young lieutenant, second lieutenant. I had just been commissioned as an armor officer and been given the incredible responsibility of leading four Abrams tanks. And so you do all the mundane work of maintaining and operating and preparing your crews to operate those tanks. But then you bring them out to the NTC. And in our first battle, it was a live fire. I had the privilege to be the lead platoon whose mission was to attack and destroy a combat security outpost. Now, I want to let you know that the lead platoon leader you send out to destroy the CSOP is not necessarily your best. So don't get the wrong idea of that. But we were going to make the most out of that. They knew I was a new lieutenant, and maybe they thought I'd learned something from this. But we get out on this valley, and the targets come up at about a mile distance, and we could see him plain as day. And we knew we were too far away to engage. And so we turned on the gas full speed, got spread apart, four tanks moving in what we call an echelon left formation, just counting down the ranges. And then I had a privilege. We were probably doing about 25 to 30 miles an hour. I had the privilege to issue a platoon fire command with a countdown, and we fired all of our tanks all at once, knocking down all three targets at about a half mile distance. And that's when I was absolutely amazed by the capability of the M1 Abrams tank. That is an incredible machine. It hits what it aims at, and it can do it at 30 miles an hour, rolling over rough terrain at half a mile distance. And so that was one of those experiences that you're like, wow, everything I've done for the last 9 months was worth it. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you that. That one is great. Drew and I had the opportunity, for the listeners here, at the opportunity to command the same brigade. So we both commanded the Raider Brigade. I was a couple commanders before him, and I had the opportunity to take the brigade to the NTC back in 2017, and we make it hard. And I spent 18 months of my life trying to figure out how to beat the OP4. And I'd like to say we won every battle, but anybody who was there on the ground will immediately be able to provide it. Incontrovertible proof that did not happen. But one of the battles I'm most proud of, we were attacking across a particular piece of ground that took us over very wide and open terrain. It's called the Whale Gap. Very, very difficult for a striker brigade to get its way through the Whale Gap just because of how open the terrain is. And one of my battalion commanders made the decision to dismount a day and a half before the attack, and he walked. And this was in August, and they walked, and they walked. They probably walked about 20 kilometers with their strikers in overwatch and following at some distance behind. The heat of day, I tried to sleep a little bit but kept moving during the night. And I'll tell you, the rest of the brigade pretty much got destroyed in detail as we approached the Whale Gap. But doggone if those about 400 soldiers that participated in that movement, they didn't get 200 of them up on top of the whale. Sure. And what that taught me is, hey, anybody who says that our soldiers aren't tough, that America's youth today is not ready for the challenges of the next fight, you need to come out to the National Training Center, and you need to meet some of these great young soldiers like the ones I just talked about, walking for a day and a half to get up on top of the whale, even though it was 110 degrees in the heat of the day. And you should have seen the fight this morning. We've got some young Americans in our Army today who are tough, who are disciplined, and I have every bit of confidence that if they have to hit the beaches in Normandy or some other similar challenge, that they're going to be up for that challenge.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's great to hear. Thanks for sharing that. I think it is important to recognize that, because the NTC always feels like a beatdown, quite frankly. You don't feel like a superhero in the moment. You're like, man, I need more sleep. I don't want to walk another, you know, however many K. I'll tell you, sir, it does highlight too that, and this may be a secret in NTC to having a good rotation. And I do think that, honestly, if you get parity when you're at NTC, you should probably count it a win. Mm-hmm. However, I think that success lies in taking the uncomfortable COA, being uncomfortable with timing, with distance, with the pace of planning. What I found in the rotations and in watching as Bronco 07 was that the commanders who pushed the throttle and said, I know we just finished a fight, we have to keep momentum, and made people uncomfortable through their timelines and uncomfortable through what they were asking of them, even though it was tough, the units still were able to respond. And in doing so, they kept the pressure on the enemy. I think that was one of the keys to success. It includes walking, like you said, securing key terrain, yep, and then pulling the vehicles forward, sir. I mean, that's a secret for anybody out there listening. You got to go the hard route at NTC.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I've had the privilege now to do 23 rotations in this job as lead six. I probably got somewhere north of 40 altogether. But 23 rotations as the commander. And so I've gotten to see commanders as they come through and as they fight in different styles and different environments. And is that instinct for opportunity that I think is one of the most profound characteristics of our great leaders. I'll give you an example, and I won't share his name, even though this is a positive story, of a particular brigade commander who took, as you describe, a beatdown, pretty heavy beatdown in an attack, and he was kind of hanging on by his fingernails. As soon as he saw that the Op 4 had culminated, immediately is reaching down to his company commanders, his battalion commanders, and saying, seize the high ground, seize that piece of key terrain so that we can set conditions for the next fight. Even in the midst of adversity, can see opportunity. We've taken a lot of licks here, but I've got combat power. I can seize a piece of high ground here, and I can set myself up for a positive advantage, a position of advantage going into the next fight. A mark of great leadership. And I think it applies broadly outside the National Training Center. You know, the ability to seize opportunity in the middle of adversity can be exported to a variety of human experiences well beyond the deserts of NTC.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Comparative story there was also an echelon left, but it was a battalion echelon left that I got to execute. Believe it or not, this was my very first rotation. And, you know, side story here, it was with a peers battalion. So I was in command of 123 up in JBLM. And my counterpart over in 2nd Brigade and Lancer Brigade, he, for some family medical reasons, could not go with his battalion. And so the division command turned to me and said, you're taking his battalion through NTC and you're leaving in 2 days. And so I had been in command for 6 weeks, and most of that was away from the team. And so this is one of the most challenging leadership challenges of my entire career. And I stepped back and grouped a little bit and said, okay, I reached out to mentors first and asked how they would go through this. And then I jumped into it. And so it was the first time I'd ever been to Fort Irwin, was that rotation. And so during that rotation, we were coming off of the Razish fight, and we had SOBI, which is the suspension. There's a pause there to do some reflection and some regrouping, and then we continue, you know, start the attack. And the brigade commander said, as soon as they call resumption of the battlefield effects, I want you to launch across just south of, in between Ugin and Granite Pass, launched from east to west, go from Moose Garden straight across over to Old Harry. And just run and gun, try to make it. I'm like, sir, I don't even have the battalion together right now. It was not pretty. However, I said, all right, rally on me. We're battalion echelon left, go. And we did. And we had about 60 vehicles out there, trudging right across the desert. And about half of them made it. But as you said, when there was a mobility kill, what did the soldiers do? They scooped up their javelins and they walked the rest of the way. And in doing so, we seized a foothold on the other side of Barstow Road. And the brigade was able to use that momentum to carry forward into the next attack up to the Matterhorn. So costly, yes, a little bit of a, you know, an interesting moment, but it did show, like you said, that that resilience of the soldier down at the level. So
absolutely. And you can see that, you know, there's 100 stories out here that tie into that same concept. It's the subtle balance between audacity and synchronization. And commanders, you know, getting that just right takes practice. Anybody who thinks you can learn this from computer games or you can do this in a classroom and not have to live it out here, hasn't had the experience of facing the enormous friction of trying to get, like you said, 700 people all oriented on the same objective on, you know, just probably a few hours notice at most, and then try to achieve the synchronization needed to safely deliver your forces through a danger area like that. It's a very delicate balance, and I'm glad that we train at that. We train in that sweet spot every day out here.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, let's take that the training aspect here that we talked about a little bit then, and then link it to what's going on in the world and in our times as far as warfare goes. So, I want to ask you about the changing character of war, and just as a reminder for the listeners out there who aren't familiar with the term, the nature of war is it's unchanging. It refers to the fundamental essence, those enduring principles of conflict, such as Clausewitz's principle that violence is carried out to achieve a political end, those things about war that never change. On the other hand, the character of war is that evolving nature in which war is conducted. It's the dynamics of the time and the technologies and the people and the social structures that affect the way that we conduct warfare. So if you would, sir, just take a look at the character of warfare now and then tell us how you are incorporating that into the training experiences for the Joint Force.
Yeah, certainly we are paying very close attention to the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict that happened, the invasion of Ukraine, and then even now Israel and Gaza, and that's just a few days old. So I think it would be presumptuous to draw too many lessons from that conflict this early on. But there's going to be a lot of lessons that come out of all three of those. And so we pay very, very close attention to those. I'll start with Ukraine and the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. What we've seen in both of those conflicts is that the battlefield is now transparent. And what we mean by that is that you can be seen and detected by so many different methods of detection throughout the depth of your battle space. At the old days where you would kind of collect on the backside of a hill and wait for the right moment and then present your formation to the enemy at a time of your choosing, those days are gone. The enemy now has – and even a sophisticated non-state actor who's got access to financial resources has many, many different ways to collect on you. They can use commercial satellite imagery. They can use cheap, inexpensive drones that just cost you too much ammunition to shoot down, and they can make them faster than you can make the bullets to shoot them down. Social media is a rich and very precise source of tactical intelligence for commanders if it can be properly leveraged on the battlefield. And so the idea that you can hide from the enemy until a time and place you're choosing is a very, very difficult proposition. And so we train that reality here all the time. The first thing we did as we began this adaptation was we bought a bunch of drones. So we have right now we have a drone swarm of 105 quadcopter drones that kind of fly in attack formation. We found 105 is a little unwieldy, so we tend to bring it down to about between 20 and 50. This morning we did a number of attacks throughout the battle space in support of the Op 4's attack, since the rotational unit was on the defense, using 50 drones. These drones are equipped with a small little like a 40 millimeter round that they can drop on a vehicle, or with they also have a laser that replicates small arms fire. And so that can be a lethal capability. It works best when it's using connection with other capabilities simultaneous, just like any weapon system on the battlefield.
What was the reaction on the ground, if you don't mind? Because I bet a lot of listeners are thinking, how do you respond to that? What do you do? I mean, was it stunned silence? Did it get into action?
Well, certainly the first time anybody encounters that threat, you know, you kind of see a little bit of a vapor lock, you know, and a little bit of I don't know how I'm supposed to respond. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. But as the unit evolves, and this particular brigade is 6 days into the fight, so they've grown tremendously. I mean, And when I'm talking 6 days, these are 24-hour days. So you can imagine the growth that we've seen in this brigade. And what we see now is we tend to treat it like artillery. And so we see the threat, we recognize the threat, and we move, we respond, we react, we seek cover where appropriate. But most importantly, we remain dispersed and we remain mobile. And that's the big lesson learned, is you have to be dispersed and you have to be mobile. It used to be the way to protect a formation in a rear area, particularly in Afghanistan and Iraq, was to pack everything really tight, put a bunch of wire outside, and if you had time, put some concrete T-walls up, put a guard at the front with a 50 caliber, and then eventually guard towers and other surveillance. That is not the way you survive in this this new world. You've got to spread out. You've got to maintain dispersion so that you can respond to these aerial threats. The second big piece of this, which ties into the drones, is the artillery. We have really brought the king of battle back to the National Training Center, and we brought him back in a big way. So in a typical day during the force-on-force portion of the rotation, the brigade will endure about 100 artillery attacks per day. We're getting to about half of the casualties that a unit will be induced by enemy indirect fire. Again, as I described, the attack this morning began not with an onslaught of masses of tanks and BMPs, but rather with a massive artillery barrage focused on C2 nodes and then on engineers and some other radar systems that were
critical.
Which
the enemy can detect with their systems. I mean, they know the C2 nodes, they see the signatures.
Mm-hmm. So you can imagine there was a detailed process throughout the night, last night, to find and fix those C2 nodes based on their signatures. And again, this is all part of the transparent battlefield. A great source of intelligence, as I said, is the internet. So we created an internal internet here at the National Training Center that's not accessible from the outside, but that has social media platforms inside it. Every one of our role players, we've got about 150 role players who role play various civilians on the battlefield. Each one of them is equipped with a phone that is connected to this internal network, and their job is if they see any military activity, whether it's friendly or enemy, they're to take a picture of it and post it on the internet. So if you're operating around a populated area, you should fully expect that somewhere on this, social media platform is a picture of your command post with appropriate terrain association. A talented adversary can determine where you're located at and target you. That's another way.
Which is exactly what's happening in Ukraine and in the theater right now, sir, right?
Exactly. The other thing we're going after, too, is personal cell phones. If you recall your history during our initial invasion into Europe and particularly in the battles in the Hurricane Forest and others, right as it started getting cold, we lost a lot of great GIs because they didn't understand that lighting a cigarette in a foxhole could get them killed. Just the simple act of indiscipline driven by a nicotine addiction to light a cigarette, it seems like such a small act. But time and time again, the Germans could detect that light, they could detect that odor, and they could call in fire and kill you and your buddies because you chose to light that cigarette. I believe the cell phone is the new cigarette in the foxhole. And that our addiction to cell phone, and not being pejorative, all of us have a certain reliance on that technology, is a critical vulnerability that we've got to get after. And we've got to learn to operate without this technology or to use it only in ways that will advance our military advantage. But the indisciplined use of cell phones will get you and your unit killed. And we've got a variety of ways that we replicate that here at NTC as well.
Yes, sir. If I could go deeper on that for just a second, because I know that there are people listening and they say, okay, they turn to their platoon, their company, maybe their squad, and say, hey guys, we got to be disciplined about this. But until there's some enforcement mechanism coming down to NTC and before NTC, because you got to train this way as well. You got to get everybody used to that. So, can you expound on what leaders are doing to condition their soldiers in a positive way? Or are we not there yet?
No, honestly, I thought this was going to be harder than it has been. And a lot of it is just establishing a clear standard and letting people know you're checking. And so we did a couple very simple things. We issued a policy that says it's the division's policy in this particular scenario that there will be no personal cell phones used in the box in the operational area. Then what we did is we gave all of our observer controllers a very simple and very very cheap commercial off-the-shelf cell phone detector And from time to time, they'll go around and collect, and then we'll notify the chain of command when we see violations. That's kind of like the radar gun in the speed trap that keeps everybody from speeding on the interstate. The other thing that we are doing, and this is really about awareness, is, you know, when you sign up for any social media platform, Facebook, X, or Instagram, whatever, that user agreement that you kind of scroll through and click on and say you agree gives the company permission to track your location, your movement, in an anonymized ad tech data. So we buy that data just like any commercial company does, and we use it. And with appropriate analysis, and this doesn't happen instantaneously, there is a lag on this, but with appropriate analysis, we can easily detect, for example, if we see a particular ad tech moving around in one point of the desert, and we backtrack 3 weeks and find that that same device was sitting out in front of the engineer headquarters back at, you know, Fort Cavazos or Fort Bliss or wherever else, then we can presume that that's an engineer unit that's now located in that piece of desert. And we use that for targeting and templating. I'll give you a great example. Recently, we had an attack aviation formation conducting an attack out of contact against a very robust air defense system. And the whole nature of the training event was they had to weave their way through this very sophisticated air defense system to get at a target using the exquisite technology of the Apache. A couple days later, we sat down with the leadership and showed them the exact track their Apache had taken as it approached the objective. One of their Apaches had taken because one of the pilots had a cell phone in the cockpit with him. And that would have compromised a significant amount of technology because it would have shown how we use our Apaches to maneuver around enemy air defense. It's those simple things that can cost us so much. So I think that awareness has driven real changes in behavior. And I'll just tell you, in the last 10 rotations, particularly since we bought those cell phone detectors, we've seen a dramatic change in behavior. People are starting to get the message.
Yes, sir. Thanks for elaborating on that. That will be a striking message for folks to hear. I bet it'll change behavior immediately back in the, you know, back on the teams. That's good. So character of war evolving the drones, cell phone, and social media technology, and then our use of artillery. It kind of in maybe the old fashioned way, right? I mean, you in your targeting, and we see it in Russia and Ukraine using infantry. Using the Russian prisoners or soldiers to move forward, draw fire, and then use combined arms and artillery to attack those Ukrainian positions. I think that was a little bit of a wake up call a few months ago when we saw that the Russians were using that tactic. Sir, what else comes to mind?
Well, I do want to highlight that we don't replicate the kind of the human wave attacks, the disposable forces being utilized by Russia. There's a variety of reasons. You know, ultimately, we're asking American soldiers to be on both sides of this fight. I think it's just a bad message to our soldiers. Plus, we don't need to replicate that. We don't, you know, I am very confident in the gunnery skills of our formations. And so we don't need to put masses of infantry or masses of vehicles kind of in an expendable way in front of them. What we do need to show them is what happens when we bring it all together, when not, you know, it's not just one instrument playing, it's the full orchestra that comes at them all at once. So the artillery is landing the same time that the chemical strike is going in the rear area, the same time that the attack aviation is coming in on their flank, and the same time there's a drone swarm in the north and a tank company, you know, on the march trying to turn the southern flank. And that's exactly what took place this morning. So we try to bring that full orchestra together. The last point of kind of innovation that I'll just highlight is the role of the narrative. And so if you paid attention to the opening months of the Ukraine-Russia conflict, you saw how quickly the Ukrainians were able to turn a strategic narrative on its head. Debunk the idea that somehow Ukraine had initiated some atrocity that caused the attack, and debunk the idea that this was a fait accompli. And they did that with a very skillful use of tactical information being applied for strategic purposes. And so we expect that our adversaries have learned from that, and we should anticipate in the first battle of the next war, there is going to be a very skillful and well thought out effort to try to portray a narrative either of American incompetence or worse, of American war crimes. And so we do that all the time here. A typical example would be if a unit is attacking to seize a particular village, then as the op four is preparing, is trying to hold on to the village and is about to withdraw, what they will do is they'll launch a major rocket strike on that village, causing all manner of civilian casualties. And I want to be clear that the U.S. Army would never do this in real life, but we believe we'll fight against adversaries that will. But they induce all these civilian casualties and then film it in such a way that it appears that the attacking U.S. forces created those casualties. This is a well-thought-out plan. It makes it into social media and then works its way into our internal news network. And here's what we want the enemy or the U.S. commander to do. We don't want him to run his own publicity campaign. He doesn't have time to be, you know, neck deep in public relations. He's got a fight on his hand. What he must do, though, is be first with the truth. And I'll tell you a great success story when we played out this particular scenario. We had a public affairs officer who immediately saw the first indications of this false narrative appearing in social media, went into the command post, gathered all the radar data of incoming rounds that had been detected during the window of the alleged atrocity, and gathered all the firing data from the artillery battalion on what we had shot, and was able to present that data to the division headquarters to show conclusively that there were, you know, 10 enemy rockets that came in that were detected at the time of the attack, and the U.S. had not fired at all.
Sure.
That matters, and that the success of those efforts is measured in minutes. And mm-hmm. you only have to look to the recent incident of the alleged Israeli attack against a hospital in Gaza to see how important that narrative is, and getting that truth up to the strategic level very, very quickly is absolutely important. Otherwise, we run the risk of winning battles and losing wars.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I can't agree with you more there. And we lived that in Syria and Iraq and in OIR 2 years ago, and it's happening now. We see it played out with the with the one-way drones that are coming in. And we had to turn the camera footage into a social media post as quickly as we could, get it declassified off of that system, and then put it over and up and out so that we could get that message out there, sir. And so, you know, while you don't typically think in our traditional warfighting function integration and battle drills, you don't think, hey, how do we make sure we get the information over to the public affairs officer as quickly as possible? You know, few people train that at home station, right? But that is something I think is relevant for today, and the units who will have been practiced at that are going to be the ones who have an easier time doing it, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. And the danger is that a commander will think, hey, look, I'm in the middle of the fight of my life. I've just taken 200 casualties. You know, I'm fighting with everything I've got left. I don't have time to do this. And if the commander is uniquely positioned, or the tactical command post is uniquely positioned to collect that ground truth. And if they're not doing that, no one can do that for them. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't emphasize this in training, we will find ourselves out of position when, you know, the White House press secretary is calling down saying, we need to know why the U.S. allegedly bombed a particular city. You know, and mm-hmm. we've got to have that muscle memory there and be prepared to respond to that strategic fight that's going to be happening. And that is modern warfare. And so you talk about adaptations. I would say that transparent battlefield, the increased use of artillery, and that whole information warfare dynamic are the three areas that we are adapting here at the NTC to the future character of war.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So if you would, let's flip to the leaders as you see the units coming through. What units are doing it well? What are the leaders doing well to get through this training opportunity that you have presented for them?
Well, I'll tell you, the very best have a real clear understanding of what they want. They communicate with great clarity, and they know their own mind. And we actually do a seminar 4 months before the rotation. All the leaders come out to the NTC. We take them through a tactical exercise. They get to see the desert, and then they spend an evening with me just kind of sitting around a table talking about the Army's concept of mission command. And we talk about what makes a great leader in combat. Come back 4 months later, and we have another discussion about, okay, well, we talked kind of philosophically about this. Now let's talk about what really happened. Mm-hmm. And it's a great learning environment. But I always ask them, what are the marks of a great leader? And you get, you know, the clarity of your thinking. The first thing a commander must know is he must know his own mind. You know, they say the great thing about Ronald Reagan, he might have forgotten your name, but he never forgot his priorities. And good commanders are very, very clear at understanding what is it they want to accomplish. And then they're able to communicate to their subordinate commanders and their staff in a way that both of them can understand. The staff can produce and synchronize an order that's consistent with the dialogue they've had with their commander. Now, that may sound simple, but man, it's hard, like most of the things in war. And so great commanders have that ability. They have the ability to visualize the fight, to understand the fight, then visualize a future end state, and then describe that end state to their subordinates. The other thing that great commanders do is they understand that trust is not an inherent right. That trusting your subordinates, while that is the aspirational goal of every echelon of command, particularly on the battlefield, that trust requires that I train and certify my commanders up front. So I would say great commanders, they train, they certify, they empower, and they trust. They do it in that order. So they spend time with their company commanders and with their fire support officer and with their engineer officer and their aviators before the fight, talking about, hey, here are my expectations. And then they require their subordinates to be certified through either, you know, company situational training exercises, battalion exercises, through tactical decision games, so that they have an appreciation that their commander, the subordinate, understands what they want. So they train, then they certify, then they empower, and then they can operate on a basis of trust based on the work that they've done. That's really, really hard to do. Sure. But that's what marks our best leaders out here at the NTC.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That is important. I'm a big fan of Max DePree's advice that the first job of a leader is to define reality. And you took that, you know, one step back. So what is reality in your own head, you know, in your own head? And then what comes to mind too, sir, and a little bit on the more personal kind of vulnerable side of the listeners and the leaders out there who are coming up on that next big job or that next big command. I say we, because I have personally stepped into every job feeling like I was unqualified and like I was having to put on my big boy pants to get the job done. And so what you described, sir, to, as you were talking, when I'm thinking about the value of the leader going through that, because it's not just about the followers, the subordinates, the team learning you. It's about you learning yourself through that process as well. Because when you cross that threshold of a little bit uncomfortable and you get in front of the team and say, okay, let's figure out how we're going to fight this, you're actually, the leader's training him or herself as well through this, because they don't have all the answers ahead of time, do they? I mean, it's something you have to iterate and you have to get better and better at. And I think that's okay for, that's part of the process of becoming the leader you're supposed to be in the job.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things we ask in this mission command seminar we do, I ask every one of the battalion commanders to define where they are on a spectrum. And there's seven different spectrum they look at. One of them is, do you believe in direct and clear specific tasks or in broad intent? And so that naturally leads us down the conversation of when it's appropriate to provide, you know, basically, you know, side rails for your unit and when it's appropriate to provide very clear and specific guidance. Because both answers are right and both answers are wrong. It's very situational dependent, and good leaders understand how to move freely up and down. They understand their natural inclination, either to the right or the left, and they understand how to move freely up and down that spectrum based on the situation. And it is a very, very difficult thing to do. I also really I'm a huge fan of General McChrystal's book, Team of Teams. I'm sure many folks have read it. If you haven't, I would encourage you to, just because it's a really well-written book. And I've adopted from his phrasing in that book that we should lead like a gardener and not like an engineer. And leaders quite often feel like it is their job to construct their formation a particular way, you know, much kind of an engineering approach to I'm going to fix this and then fix this and fix this. But great leaders think and lead, and their leadership philosophy is more like gardening, where it's my job to create the conditions in the environment for leaders to grow from the bottom up. And so, and gardening is far less predictable and far more uncertain than you know, building a brick wall. But it requires a certain amount of patience, and it requires a certain amount of detachment and a certain amount of faith. I mean, you put that seed in the soil and you put the appropriate fertilizer with it and appropriate water into it, you are operating on faith that a certain set of behaviors is going to emerge. And that's what great leadership is supposed to look like, is when you're leading like a gardener. And then I add on that, and train like a coach, because a great leader is down on the ground. He's teaching. He's engaged. He's sharing his own insight from his experience where he has it. And then he's humble and understands our doctrine and understands kind of best practice in areas where he doesn't have that that personal intuition from his own experience.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And what comes to mind as you're talking there is or the way that a leader can zoom down in to the details in a way that distracts them from the big picture. And I know I saw this over and over again. And the leader who can't step back and kind of see the ebb and flow of the organization may miss those cues or miss those times where they say, "Hey, everybody, I need to reorient you. I need to describe the fight for you and how I see it." What are some good practices that you see in leaders who, you know, battlefield circulation or driving the ops process? What are the good leaders doing to make sure that they play the role that they're supposed to for the team?
Yeah, I'll tell you, this topic, we probably have more discussions on here at the NTC than any other. And in fact, this morning, just a few hours ago, I was standing on a hilltop, Hill 720, if you're familiar with the NTC terrain, looking at a battle play out in front of me. And the discussion on the net, on the brigade command net, and what we were observing on the ground, there was great cognitive dissonance between those two. Now, you would think that that's a mark of incompetence. It's not, because my point in the discussion that we were having is that both of them are right and both of them are wrong. There are uniquely different lenses to perceive a very, very complex human dynamic that's playing out. We have thousands of people engaged in contact with one another. There are so many things going on at once that to stand on a hilltop and believe you have a clear understanding of what's going on, and to sit inside a command post and listen to a radio and think you have, both are equally inappropriate because both provide a different lens. And so the balance between when I must go where the action is and position myself there, or when I must go to the where the information is a really, really difficult balance. And we see leaders in history struggle with that all the time. Norman Cota, the commanding general of the 28th Infantry, who was the hero of Omaha Beach. He was the first. He was the one-star general that landed there and led the initial attack through the Varaville Draw off the beach. Incredibly heroic person, by his own admission, talks about how he failed to see the battle in the Hurricane Forest playing out well because he was tied to his command post during a time that he should have been forward to visualize. And so I use his personal confessions in that particular fight as a great example of just how hard it is to get that right. And I think good commanders have a healthy insecurity about their positioning. And when they go forward, they bring as much of the information with them. They bring the right radios and the right leaders with them to help them communicate. And when they go back to their command post, where they have a much broader set of information, that they have a healthy insecurity that the information they're getting might, and a healthy skepticism about the information that's coming over the radio, because they recognize that that's only one lens through which to see the fight.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thanks for expanding on that. I think that's important because we tend to think that because we're responsible for everything, that we have to be involved in every aspect of the fight and have to do everything. And what that leads to, unfortunately, too often is an 06 with one hand mic and one FM net running a fight of thousands, and it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. Absolutely. We see that all the time. And I think this is an important leadership lesson that goes beyond just the battlefield, but it is seen most acutely in the battlefield. What we talk with brigade commanders about is, look, I know you're a humble and caring leader, and you would never want, you're going to be the last to eat. You're gonna let your soldier sleep in the good spot, and you're gonna sleep in the bad spot. That's the kind of leaders that we grow, and that humility is great. But you need to be a little selfish about the information you surround yourself with. And you need to make sure you've got good people because you are expected to make really, really important decisions. And what that means is you got to have the right people around you helping you to provide you with analysis and understanding, not advice. Because in the time-constrained environment of the battlefield, I don't need someone who's looking at the same thing as me and offering their conclusions. What I do need is someone who is receiving information from a different stream than I am and can provide me analysis and perspective based on that. And again, that's relevant to the time-constrained battlefield. But I think there's an important lesson in that is you got to surround yourself with really good people and recognize that you will be influenced by those people. And so, again, we do see plenty of brigade commanders up on the hill, closed door in their Humvee, with a map board on their map, trying and giving every bit of intellect and effort that they have to try to understand the fight. And they're just not good enough to do it. They have to be surrounded by a group of talented folks who are bringing independent and separate analysis and different lenses of looking at the fight and sharing that with the commander.
Yes, sir. And trying to do that on 3 hours of sleep for the last right. 8-9 days, which is a whole nother topic in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Sir, in that scenario, how important is it for leaders to have established a climate in the organization and on their staff where people can give them input, can feedback to them, and give them ideas? How important is that, and how do you see it play out there?
Yeah, I think that culture is very, very important. That's something we try to emphasize in our after-action reviews. We very much want a good AAR as a dialogue. It's not just simply a one-way exchange between the senior person in the room and the person adjudicating the after-action review. And it can become that if you're not careful. Good AARs, the best AAR is one where someone in the back of the room says, hey, sir, you failed to understand this particular aspect of the fight, and I had this piece of information, but for whatever reason, you know, it didn't make it to you and didn't influence your decision-making as it should have. That's a healthy organization. That's what we want, where people feel comfortable kind of calling out the boss, if you will, and that's the mark of the right culture that we need to have in an organization. Mm-hmm. Because, again, the battlefield is so complex. And the lenses through which we see the battlefield, it's a kaleidoscope, and you just turn it 5 degrees and you get an entirely different pattern. That healthy skepticism about the information that you have versus what the person next to you, what the young sergeant who's looking at the GMTI, moving target indicators, might have a different perspective, or the young artilleryman who's tracking the round counts. You know, you may want to kill 10 more targets with your artillery, but you may have enough ammo to kill 5. His piece of information is pretty relevant to that. So good commanders understand how to shape their information requirements and bring that data together. But like all things, there's a limit to this. At some point, the commander must decide, and the commander must collapse the available decision space and say, okay, I've heard the input, and now we're moving out in this direction. And quite often, a very caring, empathetic, and open commander becomes stuck in analysis paralysis. So there is a time when all that input is relevant, and that input will invariably be contradictory. There is a time when a decision must be made. The commander has to collapse the decision space to allow the staff to move forward with a directed course of action. And knowing where that moment is the subtle art of command.
So before we get, I'm gonna give you in a moment, here, I'll give you a chance to talk about life in NTC, being an OC and kind of what that experience is like. Cause I think a lot of people are ill-informed and under-informed about that. I do want to give a shout out to several of the people who submitted questions. I sent out an email to the military leader community and got several responses back. One question that Rashonda Thomas offered is, how is NTC creating an environment of contested logistics, and are there any simulated port scenarios, RSOI? Maybe you could take a second to talk about expeditionary RSOI for those who haven't haven't seen it.
Yeah, a couple things that came to mind on this question. First, the great challenge of the National Training Center is the tactical problem of distance. And so I get asked all the time, hey, I thought we were focusing on a Pacific scenario. How possibly is the desert appropriate to replicate a Pacific scenario? I think it's perfect, because what we can do out here in the National Training Center is replicate distance. In the extreme distance over which supplies and equipment and capability and communications must travel in a Pacific scenario is extreme. We replicate that here at the NTC with extended distances and extended lines of communication and extended distances over which we must communicate with our tactical systems. On the issue of contested logistics, I'll give an example. This brigade has been attacking for 6 days, as I described. And during that time, they've stretched their logistics nodes to well in excess of 50 kilometers. By the end of the rotation, they'll be well over 100 kilometers, which coincidentally is not far off from the distance between the Belarusian border to the city of Kyiv, about 130 kilometers. It's typically how far we get in a standard rotation. We have created in this particular scenario a river using an old dry riverbed here that we're replicating as a river. So they have to force that huge flow of logistics and sustainment through the eye of a needle. To get across, bridge crossing sites, and you can imagine that's the focus for the enemy's targeting and counteroffensives is to retake those bridges. So these are contested logistics, contested every step of the way, and using the enemy's extended fires capability, he's constantly taken out. He's been going after fuel for a while, and typically does, and going after artillery ammo and other commodities that he knows are in short supply, and are required to sustain offensive tempo. Moving into future rotations, we have a division rotation plan in a couple months where we'll be replicating the full capability of a division headquarters with its supporting functional brigades, the sustainment, the aviation, and the fires brigades in a fight, a replicated fight over a much greater distance. The division is going to have to sustain itself all the way from the Marine Corps base where we typically download our equipment at a railhead and then move it about 70, 80 kilometers just to get into the box. And then there's another 130 kilometers after that. So you can imagine the distances that they're going to have to replicate. While they're doing that, the division commander is going to be bringing lift helicopters out of Fort Bliss, Texas to resupply his formation to replicate again that contested logistics over distance. I would say the closest we get to replicating a port just because of the nature of the mission we're training is as we replicate that contested intermodal download site at the Marine Corps base. And that's how we get after contested logistics. But you have to fight to get water. You have to fight to get fuel. You have to fight to get ammunition here on the battlefield.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That was a shock to the system, I think, for the first units to go through Expeditionary RSOI. And for those of you who have experienced it, you get off the train, and as you said, the fight starts right away. And you, when you get to, it used to be that you had 10 days to unpack and stretch out and get ready for the match. And it starts the instant you hit the ground there. But I'll tell you, for any of the commanders and logisticians out there, going to NTC without having set up your BSA is kind of like going to your M4 qual without having zeroed. It is just painful. It is really painful. Yeah. And so take every chance you can get to set up that logistics infrastructure so you don't have to learn it on the fly.
Yeah. And I would say on that too, there is no substitute for training in the dirt. There is none. It is, the friction is so much harder. There's occasionally parts of the rotation that we need to replicate. Maybe we don't get a fighter squadron to support us for a particular rotation or work with us. And so we might have to replicate that, or we might have to replicate fires for whatever reason. And we find that the friction in those elements that we replicate is so much lower than the things that are actually in the box, because it's very easy to cheat, if you will, on things that are part of a computer game. We find that the targets are always found and the targets are always hit and those kinds of things. When you get out in the dirt, that's when you see the full friction that Clausewitz talked about in his famous book on war. And it's the side that can most rapidly overcome the natural friction of the battlefield and to achieve combined arms effects that's going to dominate in a future conflict. And that side has got to be us.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely. We'll start to close it down here in a second. Let's talk about NTC for a minute. I mentioned I've been an OCT at Hohenfels. I've done a couple rotations as augmenting during the brigade validation exercises. I was fortunate to be Bronco 07 watching brigades fight down there before COVID stopped us cold. I have found in every instance that being an OC is incredibly professionally rewarding beyond really any other experience, because you are so immersed in the core aspects of our profession, and you become such a good warfighter because you live and breathe it day in and day out. And so before I came to Fort Irwin, I didn't know what to expect, maybe a little bit hesitant about the job, and you just hear stories running around the Army. So if you would just explain a little bit about what life is like there, and then maybe give them your sales pitch about what they can get out of coming to NTC.
Thank you for asking that. And I'd like to start with a quick story. So there I was just a few months before 9/11. I'm a troop commander in Korea, and I'm standing out on a hill late at night in some exercise, and my brigade commander came up and said, "All right, Captain Taylor, what do you want to do next?" And I had been Googling around on the internet, and had set upon a program called the Harvard Strategist Program. And I said, "Sir, I want to go to Harvard." Now, I have great respect for that institution, great institution. But my brigade commander turned to me and he said, "Okay, that's great." He said, "What do you want to do with your career?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'd like to go on and maybe command a battalion one day." And he said, "Look, if that's what you want to do, then rather than getting a master's degree from Harvard, you need to get a PhD in war fighting." And he said, "I'm going to send you to the National Training Center." So fortunately, this was in Korea. It was about 20 below in, my wife was in Minnesota. It was about 20 below at the time when I called her up and told her we were going to the desert, Fort Irwin. She said, "Is it warm there?" I said, "I'm told it is." And so she agreed to come with me, and we came out to Fort Irwin. Now, I'll tell you, I don't know what I would have learned in Harvard again. Greatest respect for that that institution. But I learned how to fight at the National Training Center because I spent every day and every night, you know, many, many nights sitting around a campfire in some wadi somewhere waiting on the battle the next morning, talking about war fighting and talking about all these complex issues. And what I didn't realize at the time, 9/11 happened between that conversation and me showing up at the NTC. But then what came shortly thereafter, as we all recall, was the invasion of Iraq. I didn't realize how important what I would learn there would be to me in the future. And so shortly after I was an OC, just a few months later, I found myself as a battalion S3 sitting on the Sunni Shia fault line in the middle of a really, really tough fight where we were stuck between really in the midst of a civil war. And I don't know what I would have learned in Harvard, but the skills I learned at the National Training Center paid off for my soldiers every day. So what I also learned when I was at NTC is that I really love two things. I love fighting and I love being a dad. And those are the two things that are probably most important to me along with my faith. And I got to do both of those all the time at the NTC. What I tell new soldiers all the time is you will find no other assignment where you spend more time in the field, focused on warfighting, and more time with your family than anywhere else in the Army. And that was my experience here. Very predictable schedule. We conduct about 9 rotations a year. They're all about 14 days each. You come in and out of the field during the course of that. You spend your time really driving around in your own Humvee, out there mentoring and training a unit that's going through the toughest event of their 2-year training cycle. But you learn how to fight. And then you come home, you wash yourself off, you turn in some AAR notes, and you go and you pick your kids up at the pool and you spend the rest of the day with them. And I loved it out here as an OC. Now, for the families, we spend a lot of time making sure this is a great community. It's remote. There's no question about that. But the community events we have here are like no other. We just had an Oktoberfest event a few weeks back that had 3,400 people at it. That's in a city of 15,000. 3,400 people at that event. We had a concert recently that had about 60% of the population at that concert. The sense of community you get here is like nowhere else. And I hear that time and again from our soldiers and from our families. There's a saying here among the spouses that you cry when you get here and you cry when you leave. Because the quality of friendships and relationships that you build with fellow warriors and their families is like nowhere else in the Army. So as a statistic, to prove that I'm not just selling propaganda here, as you know, every unit tracks its reenlistment rate and tracks how many of those reenlistments are for home station stabilization. Right now, Fort Irwin has the highest home station stabilization rate in Forces Command. So that's out of about 40 installations. And I just ask your listeners to think about that for a minute. More soldiers per capita reenlist to stay at Fort Irwin, out in the middle of the desert, than any other installation as a percentage of their population. That says something about purpose and about community. And I think people find it out here. They enjoy the predictable schedule. They enjoy the tight-knit community. And they enjoy the opportunity to focus on warfighting.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I agree with you. There is no other experience like you can get at NTC or one of the other CTCs. So good. Thanks for that. And A Marketplace is open. So, if you're interested, I'm sure you can reach out to the team there. And I know the guest OC opportunity is there too. So if someone's curious about it, they can come out and serve in one of the rotations, can't they?
Yeah, absolutely. We have probably about 50 to 100 guest OCTs per month. And they rotate out and spend a month with us. and get that great experience training forces and learning what life is like here at the National Training Center. I think it's a great training event. And I would encourage those of your listeners who are leading soldiers to sign up for those guest OCT taskings and send your best leaders, send your future company commanders, your future first sergeants, your future battalion commanders out on these guest OCT taskings. Don't think of it as, hey, I'm losing a leader for, you know, three to four weeks, but I'm gaining a set of skills in my formation that I can't get any other way.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. That's great. Well, good, sir. Well, I would be mindful of your time there, because I know you got a fight to get back to, and it's clear that you all are dedicated to making our force as lethal as possible to win that first fight. So I just want to thank you for sharing your insight with the military leader community. I know that the leaders will get a lot out of this conversation. We'll take notes. And if you didn't take notes when you're listening to this, then you must have been driving, because there's a ton that you can get out of this. And I want to encourage everyone listening to go and do something with what you've heard. You know, we hear insight all the time, but unless we put it into practice, it just dies, right? And so we put it in practice, we become better leaders, and then we pass it on to our teams. We share it with our network, maybe it's social media, maybe you just forward an email to your team and say, hey, check this out, this conversation, here's what I thought about it. And this can be the catalyst to start a conversation that you and your team need to have to get better for your rotation that's maybe coming up. So I want to encourage you to be a conduit and not a roadblock for those leadership lessons and insight. And sir, I know you empowered the leaders today to do just that. So best of luck as you and the NTC team continue to train the force to win that first fight, sir. We truly appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I'll tell you, if you just want to get connected, follow us on Facebook. Follow us. We've got a boatload of resources available on our website there with Ops Group NTC. Follow our X page and our Instagram, because as we learn these lessons, we're producing products. We're now putting out podcasts across all of our teams. And putting out a great video series on YouTube called TAC Talks that get at some of these tough tactical issues. And I'd encourage your readers to take a look at that and listeners to take a look at that. Thank you so much, Drew, for your time. And thank you for your commitment to our profession and commitment to building great leadership.
Awesome, sir. Thanks so much. We'll see you again soon.